I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Okay, it might have been the most overused word of the year just passed, but we keep having to use it at the start of the new one. Unprecedented. Georgia elects its first ever African-American U.S. senator as voters turned out in unprecedented numbers for three runoff elections. Unfortunately, the numbers of coronavirus cases in this state have hit unprecedented levels, too, putting record stress on our healthcare system. So it's only right to start 2021 with a special live edition, late lunch edition, if you will, of the Political Breakfast. A warm welcome to you all, whether you're listening at 90.1 WABE, catching us on Facebook, on a stream, or on the podcast. However you're listening, we're delighted you're here. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson are here again, perhaps with both eyes open. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks, Dennis. Good to be back.
Good to be here, Dennis. Great day for our democracy.
Our colleague Rose Scott a little while ago called you guys Ren and Stimpy. So, Theron, you're probably happy, happy, joy, joy right now.
I am. And shout out to Rose. And I was just telling Brian, you know, Rose don't invite me on her show anymore. So I think I got a little making up to do there. But no, Dennis, we're going to jump right in. You know, first and foremost, you know, Brian and I were up last night to about 1:30 this morning. We started at 6 o'clock, for about 6:30 and went till about 1:30. And I think, you know, just to really keep the sort of vibe for this podcast going, and that is, I think we got to just start off by thanking the voters. I mean, we can get into the partisanship here in a minute, but to have almost roughly 5 million people, once the votes are all said and done, be close to that number, but we know it's over 4 million people actually vote. I mean, that's just pretty remarkable. And then, you know, huge shout out to the poll workers and the election chiefs and the election office workers and the Secretary of State's office and all those folks who really, quite frankly, did their best to get it right. And we are not a national embarrassment today on the voting. And so while I feel great that Democrats have been waiting for this moment, Dennis, for 18 years. And how I come up with 18 is because in 2002, mm-hmm. I remember that night when Sonny Perdue, who at the time was in the legislature, state legislature, defeated, or maybe had come out of the legislature, one or the other, but he defeated Roy Barnes, who was the governor at the time, a Democrat.
I was at Roy Barnes's headquarters that night.
I was there too. I remember walking across to that hotel, and it was very sad. But, you know, all our podcast listeners, you know what I'm going to say. And that is that I've been saying since we started this podcast over 5 years ago, and Brian's heard me say it, that Georgia was on the cusp. You know, we kept saying year after year, Brian would make fun of me, and he did in a very respectful, sensible Republican way. But I kept saying the demographics are changing. You know, this is going to be the year. This is going to be the year. Well, Dennis, 2020 has been the year. And I want to give a shout out to a good friend of mine who I know Brian knows. And I don't want to steal this from him, but a gentleman named Keith Mason. And for those of us,
longtime Democratic strategist, guru,
yeah.
I believe was in the Carter administration.
And I think worked for Zell Miller mm-hmm. while he was governor. But he said, you know, this has been a long time coming. And he said that Georgia was the most successful state in the country for Democrats this cycle. We flipped the presidential race, so we won the Biden-Harris ticket. We basically got two U.S. Senate seats, right? We beat two incumbents, and we were able to take back a congressional seat. And so when you really look at it in that context, to me, Dennis, that just shows you not only did the South, particularly Georgia, have something to say, but, you know, Democrats have been working very hard for this moment to turn Georgia blue again.
Brian, let me pick up on that, because Theron just implied what some of the runs, hits, and errors were from this runoff election. Your quick take on sort of what were the trends, perhaps, the counties that turned the tide, the voting groups that mattered, the things that didn't happen for Republicans, you know, as you look at the box score here.
Well, you know, one thing that Theron and I discussed last night as we were watching returns come in is that the big turnout winner of the night was Georgia's black voters. I mean, they had a phenomenal turnout. And Theron's very defensive about this, but, you know, he does not like the fact that Republicans have pointed out correctly that traditionally black voters have not been good runoff turnout voters. They do a great job in the general, and then there's a big fall off. And Republicans did have a good runoff turnout machine, and that has led to Republicans winning every runoff since 1988 in this state. That is a remarkable run of success for one party. And that said, I reject arguments that Republicans didn't turn out well. I mean, we had over 4.4 million people vote, over 2 million for each party. That is a remarkable turnout success for Republicans and for Democrats. And this is a razor-thin majority. And so when you win by a razor-thin majority, there's still this compulsion to say, oh, the winner did everything right and the loser did everything wrong. No, that's not true. Both sides did a really good job of getting out their people.
But let's look at a couple of counties outside the immediate metro area. Baldwin County in central Georgia, where Milledgeville is, as pointed out by Rahul Bali of the Oconee Radio Group, John Ossoff won Baldwin County with 52% of the vote. Now, it's not a ton of votes, but Senator Perdue won Baldwin County over John Ossoff in November. And in Whitfield County in northwest Georgia, where President Trump led that election eve rally, turnout ran below the statewide average, this in a Republican stronghold. So, Brian, I know we had a lot of turnout on both sides, but did the Republicans fall below their expectations for the kind of turnout they needed?
They did not fall below their expectations. Here's what I was being told by a really smart Republican consultant yesterday afternoon. And I say he's really smart, but he was wrong on this. There was conventional wisdom amongst some Republican consultants that if overall turnout yesterday on Election Day was over 850,000, that was a tremendously good sign for the Republicans. If it was below 750,000, it was almost a guaranteed Democrat win. Somewhere in the middle could be a split decision. Well, that was wrong. We had 1.2 million people show up, maybe even more, and that theory didn't hold. The theory that the bigger the turnout on Election Day, the greater the chance of Republicans winning. What we saw that I think was that defied that conventional wisdom was that, yes, Republicans did turn out in greater numbers on Election Day, but more Democrats than were anticipated also showed up. And I would be interested in Theron's take, because Theron said something to me back in November when President Trump came to Rome and did that last minute rally up there in northwest Georgia. And Theron said, I think that Rome rally is why Biden won, because it also turned out Democrats. He may be onto something there, and that may have happened again. You know, one point that I made in a story that's now in the New Yorker that just went up a few minutes ago is, you know, Kelly Loeffler got up at that rally Monday night and said, I'm going to contest the Electoral College on Wednesday. Now, that was an effective message for the people sitting in front of her. That's what they wanted to hear. They were loyal Trumpers. They want to see their senator fight for the president. They are part of the Stop the Steal movement, et cetera. But Democrats were watching that too. And one thing that I was postulating last night in that late night interview with the New Yorker was, how many Democrats saw it and thought, you know, honey, cancel our lunch plans tomorrow. We're going to go to the elementary school and vote. You know, I mean, because they reacted to it as well. So it was a turnout scheme for Republicans. That was also a turnout scheme for Democrats. And I think that showed up on Election Day. And, you know, as far as like county by county, sure, he did. Purdue probably did worse in some places this time than he did the last time. I saw similar numbers like in Bullitt County, where Statesboro is. He did not perform as well as he had the first go round. On the flip side, you look at Hall County, which is Gainesville, a place where the Republicans got about 70% of the vote. Election Day turnout there in November was 15,000. Yesterday, it was 24,000. So there are places where there was a surge. We saw strong turnout in Cherokee, strong turnout in Forsyth. Those are, you know, big Republican counties, lots of votes there. So Republicans in these places did turn out. Rural turnout, which is key to Republican victory statewide, was consistent and steady throughout the state, but it wasn't gangbusters, right? And I think that was probably what kept Purdue, for now, just below where Ossoff is. If the rural turnout had been a little bit better, I think that could have been where that made up the difference.
Theron, hold on to the thought, because I want to play another analysis that ties directly into that. This is from Gabriel Sterling, the Voting Systems Implementation Manager in the Secretary of State's office and a Republican. He's been on this podcast and on our live editions, actually. Not only did he give Democrats credit for organizing a good ground game, he went to exactly the point Brian was making and laid part of the blame for the Republican loss directly at the president's doorstep. And here's what he had to say.
It was an impressive feat by whoever did it to get 100,000 people to show up on a January election who did not show up in a November election. Probably a margin. My assumption is that those are probably Democrat voters, given the demographics we've seen of that. And that is a testament to hard work that was done while Republicans were busy attacking the governor and my boss. The Democrats were out there knocking on doors and getting people to turn out to vote.
All right, Theron, a lot to chew on there. Some of the things that Brian said, and of course, the take that we just got from Gabe Sterling.
Yeah, let me try to really quickly unpack a lot of this. And first of all, I feel for my good friend Brian, because he knows this. For the last 6 years, I've had to come on this podcast and do exactly what he just did, and that is try to justify the defeat. You know, try to, you know, really find some bright spots, some counties that kind of, you know, turned out for Democrats, but ultimately we would lose. So let's start with Gabe Sterling. One of the things I said last night before Brian and I started our early part of the podcast, and Brian will back me up on this, I predicted, and I'll tell you why I predicted it in a second, that the increase of African-American voters or Democratic voters, but particularly African-American voters, those who, for whatever reason, Dennis, did not vote in November, but those who came out in December, we're going to be the difference maker in this race. And Brian will back me. I made that prediction right when the polls closed. And the reason I made that prediction, Dennis, is because I was very fortunate to be a part of a small group of very smart people. And we had a super PAC called Battleground Georgia. And we specifically focused on African-American registered voters. It was roughly about 940,000 that were registered but did not vote in November. And our target was 100,000 voters. So for Gabe Sterling to go on today and say, hey, someone deserves a lot of credit, well, that credit should go to Battleground Georgia, because it was a group of people that I work with that we specifically focused on that. The second thing I want to say is that, Dennis, you'd like for us to really go county by county. And it's really, honestly, just one county. And it's a county that we talk about on this podcast a lot. And it was DeKalb County. Democrats should be thanking DeKalb County, because not only did DeKalb County show up and show out, and yes, Fulton did what they traditionally will do. Clayton always shows up big. Cobb and Gwinnett had huge turnout. But it was when the DeKalb County numbers came in. And it wasn't so much that the numbers were just high, but it was the margin of the victory, right? And so that's why when my good friend Brian was feeling good around 9 o'clock, I wasn't worried. I just sipped a little bit more tequila. And I knew by the time it came to like 10:30, once the votes start coming in metro area, it was going to be the difference maker. And then last thing I want to say is this. I absolutely agree with Brian. I said this last night. He gave a lot of credit to Black voters. And I told him I'm this close to getting him to support Black Lives Matter. But he's acknowledged that he and it's really honorable for him to do this. Dennis, it was Black voters, because what Brian just described to you is a strategy that Republicans have had in place for a very long time in this state. And that is, if you make it to a runoff as a Republican, you'll be fine. Because why? Democrats don't come back out and vote in large numbers. And more importantly, African-American voters don't come back out. So we basically destroyed that narrative. We destroyed that myth. And I will tell you this as I close. I talked to a very high-ranking Republican today. Brian knows when I say that, it's only usually about a few people. And when this high-ranking Republican told me is that Donald Trump did the one thing that Republicans did not want to do, and that is gave Democrats a reason to go out again and vote against him. And people say that Donald Trump was not on the ballot. Yes, he was. His name wasn't on the ballot this time. But when he came down here with that rally and did all that stuff and had two U.S. senators who felt so beholden to him because they feared him and his base, he gave us an additional reason to come out and vote for the two Democratic Senate candidates.
And on that point, as we speak, just a few moments before we started this podcast, the president was at a rally in Washington trashing Brian Kemp, and we're going to get to that in a moment, calling him dumb, among other things. But Brian, let me try to maybe nail down that point that Theron just made. Again, as we speak, there was that third runoff race. Now, it has not been called as we speak, but it appears that Republican incumbent Public Service Commissioner Bubba McDonald will hold on to his seat in a close race over Democratic challenger Daniel Blackmun. Now, the president was not a factor in that race. He didn't go talk about Bubba McDonald and boost him. So, as Theron was saying, Brian, is that evidence that Democrats owe their stronger showing in the other races to the president? That when the president is not a lightning rod, Republicans win runoff races?
Well, I said last night that the Bubba McDonald PSC race was a bit of a generic ballot race. Now, let me tell you what that means. In a generic ballot is when a pollster calls you and they're like, if the election were today, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat for U.S. House? No names attached, because having a name attached could change your opinion based on a personal thing with that person. And the PSC race traditionally has been a generic ballot race that just tells you where the parties are in the state. Now, that's not 100% true in this case. Bubba McDonald has been in public life in this state for 4 decades or more.
He's been a Democrat and a Republican.
That's right. Ran for governor as a Democrat back probably in the, 1990, maybe somewhere around there, a long time ago. So he's been around a long time, was in the state house, been on the PSC for many, I think probably since 2002 was when he first got elected to the PSC. So he's a known quantity, has traveled the state, and he obviously got a lot of Democratic votes as well. There's no other way to get to where he did. He had some bipartisan support. And so he's this unique situation where he was just enough of a known quantity that it gave him a bit of a margin that helped him. And nobody knew who his Democratic opponent was. I mean, I don't think Theron could point out his opponent in a lineup of Democratic candidates. He was, an unknown quantity. So what it shows is that Republicans still are competitive in the state, but they were facing some tremendous headwinds in the Senate race. One theme that I have gone to a lot here on Political Breakfast is we aren't just fighting the Democrats in this runoff. The Republicans have been fighting Republicans, and it has divided the party. And I think Perdue and Loeffler and their campaign teams were caught in a vice where they had to choose between bad options, right? And they had no choice but to stick with the president, stick with the president's worldview. Otherwise, he could have turned on them. I mean, we've seen him go after Tom Cotton this week, Mike Lee, Mitch McConnell, Brian Kemp. So they would not have been spared that. They could not take that risk so much on the line.
Let me just push back on that for a second, because on Election Day, back in November, President Trump ran behind Kelly. Kelly Loeffler was in a multi-candidate race, so let's leave it. He ran behind David Perdue. He has managed, as we've been saying, to possibly be one of the reasons why they lost two Senate seats. So in retrospect, Brian, and then Theron, I want to hear your take on this. Did Republicans make a mistake in tying themselves to him here in Georgia?
They had no choice. I absolutely stand by that. With one tweet that cost $0 in a race where we spent $800 million, Trump could have destroyed any chance that they had by depressing the Trump base. Yes, Perdue outperformed Trump. State House and State Senate Republicans outperformed Trump. Our congressional delegation Republicans outperformed Trump. Absolutely, because there was a margin of people, a very small margin, that voted for Biden and then straight ticket Republican. They were the decisive margin, however, in the general election.
And you even said that Kelly Loeffler would pivot after the primary and in the runoff try to go after a more moderate conservative coalition. She didn't do that, and she lost.
Yeah, can't argue with you on the bottom line facts there. But they did talk to some degree about the PPP, about efforts to save jobs in Georgia during the pandemic. They did talk about building the military back up. So they did talk about some general election issues and draw contrast with the Democrats on the border, on defunding the police, on health care, on packing the court. So those are legit general election issues, and they did discuss them. I saw that David Perdue ad about a million times where he goes, "No compromise." Yeah. Is that what you want? But then he goes on to talk about legitimate issues, and she did the same. So I do disagree a little bit. I mean, we didn't see Attila the Hun during the runoff, right? I mean, we didn't see them talking we didn't see them talking about BLM. So it was a pivot. It wasn't necessarily, played to the middle, but it was a pivot.
Yeah, but it was through the lens of President Trump, because she refused to even take a stand on whether she agreed with the president or when he attacked the guy who appointed her, Governor Kemp. Theron, real quick.
Yeah, I think, listen, there's going to be a deep dive into the numbers and analysis on this runoff. And it's just a few things that really stuck out to me, Dennis. So let's just go back from the first podcast that we had after the November election. One, I was happy to be back because you guys had kicked me off the podcast because I was trying to go elect the president, and I'm just joking, guys.
It was all in good fun.
We have a rule in place. So, but give Brian credit. Brian said that it was going to be this massive shift, that they're going to move to the middle. And they tried. But the problem was how they started out their runoff campaigns. Let me give you guys the difference. Reverend Raphael Warnock, who we're going to talk a lot about during this hour, came out and legitimately said, literally said, they're going to attack
puppies.
Me. Yeah, they're going to know. Before he got to the puppies, remember the first ad was, they're going to tell you a bunch of lies, they're going to make up a bunch of stuff about me. And then he came back with the puppies, right? John Ossoff came out right away and went right on the air and started talking about the pandemic, right? Start talking about healthcare, start talking about jobs. David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler start attacking the two Democratic candidates. David Perdue said he was a privileged, kid who never had a real job and trust fund baby. He was even calling him a trust fund baby last night. Kelly Loeffler came out and just repeated, radical liberal Raphael Warnock. The point that I'm making to our listeners and our viewers is that the Democrats were better prepared, and we did not have a president who was bringing us down. The thing that last night showed us, Dennis, is that the Trump coalition that we thought, that a lot of people thought was so powerful in Georgia, it lost again. And I think when Republicans get to that point, when they realize that Trump did hurt them, Trump is the reason why these two U.S. senators lost. They didn't have a money problem. I mean, David Perdue was a six-year incumbent, right? It was because they were latched to a very unpopular president in Georgia. And we didn't just win yesterday off Black votes or Asian votes or Hispanic votes. I said this before, Dennis, we had some good white people, too, that not only voted for the Democrats in November, but they came back out and voted for them again last night and yesterday. And they, well, you know, they came out and voted for them in droves. The other point I want to make is this, is that, you know, the narrative game starts now. You know, why did Republicans lose and why did Democrats win? And the narrative that I really want to put in place is that this has been a long time coming. And Brian touched on this. It was the infighting amongst the Republicans. I believe that when Senator Loeffler and Senator Perdue attacked Brad Raffensperger, basically asked him to resign to appeal to this Republican base that Trump so-called controlled, and there were other people who said this in the Republican Party on an election day, that to me created a huge amount of dissension amongst the Republicans in general. Democrats, we have our issues. Lord knows we fight, but we kept it all internal. We were united and we made sure we turned out. And so I think that the thing that is really playing out right now, even as we are here, there are Trump protesters basically shutting down the U.S. Capitol, right?
Just about to tell you that. Yes.
They're fighting with the Capitol Police.
They had to they had to recess the session for certifying the Electoral College.
So if you're Senator Loeffler and you're Senator Perdue this morning and you're waking up, you're saying, you know what? This was always about him. He didn't come to Georgia this week to try to get them elected. He came down here and tried to double down on Brian Kemp, said he's going to, you know, campaign against the guy, you know, had the call with Raffensperger when he wanted him to legally go find 11,000 plus votes. And so I just think that, you know, I want to spend less time talking about the things that the Republicans didn't do and more time talking about what Democrats did right to win these elections.
But the Republicans still have some sorting out to do, and we will get into that and a look at what lies ahead for the Democrats and one or two other things if we have time. And we welcome your questions on our Facebook page. We will try to get to those. If you're listening to us live on Facebook, by all means, submit your questions on our Facebook page, and we'll try to get to those as well. We will take a quick break, and the Political Breakfast will continue. Stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at georgiahealthinitiative.org.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast, the special live edition on 90.1 WABE. It's also a podcast, and we're live on Facebook Live. So welcome to all of you, however you are listening. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson, Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. And we should point out, as we are speaking, there are continuing to be disturbances at the United States Capitol. Demonstrators supporting President Trump have broken through the fences around the Capitol, and some have gotten in. According to some reports, at least Vice President Pence had to be taken out, obviously, for security. And they had to recess the certification session for the Electoral College. So we'll keep our eye on that as we continue live here. Let's take a look real quickly at the sorting out that Republicans have to do. Brian Kemp, the governor might have had, in one sense, a bad night. One could argue that anyway, because his hand-picked candidate, Senator Loeffler, lost. But in another sense, and Theron, I'll start with you on this, he could have caught a break because the man that President Trump wants to challenge Kemp for the GOP gubernatorial nomination next year, Doug Collins, now has another option, running for that Senate seat that he wanted in the first place and taking on now Senator-elect Warnock. If he does that, Kemp's strongest GOP challenger would suddenly be out of the gubernatorial equation, and Theron, then Senator Warnock would face a really strong Republican challenger if he wins the nomination. So let me start with you. Is this kind of a double-edged sword for both Governor Kemp and the new senator?
So, you know, so Governor Kemp showed up at the Republican, I think it was a dual election night event for both U.S. senators, and he spoke a lot about, you know, why he chose Senator Loeffler. And I want to make sure I get this name right. It was Harrison Deal, right, Brian? Yeah. So he did a prayer for Harrison Deal, young man who lost
his
life.
The young campaign worker who was very close to the Kemp family. Yeah.
Yeah. Car accident. And so, you know, for Brian and I, we know Governor Kemp, you know, and I think that he was at that point sort of saying, hey, you know, beyond politics, like a life was lost, and it was very close to the Loeffler campaign, but more importantly, close to the Kemp family. And so he wakes up the next morning after the election day, Dennis, and he immediately got to start thinking about 2022, because here's the challenge for Governor Kemp. He is more than likely going to get a primary opponent. President Trump blatantly said that I'm going to come back to Georgia and campaign against him. So check, he knows he's going to have a tough primary, but you don't know who it's going to be. Would it be former Congressman Doug Collins? Could it be, you know, one of the constitutional officers there? You know, I've said this before. Could Brad Raffensperger, Secretary of State, decide to maybe run for higher office? And so then your candidate who you handpicked, who spent, I think upwards to $500 million collectively, right? I mean, I think at the end of the day, when the numbers are all done, all the campaigns collectively almost spent $1 billion total, just went down in flames. But let's really pay attention to the tone of Senator Loeffler. She didn't just concede. Now, my good friend Brian knows where I'm going with this. He hammered, I mean, he crushed, and I'm gonna say it like he said, he crushed, you know, Stacey Abrams for not conceding, right? Oh, it was in a, she didn't concede last night, right? What did she say? I'm going to Washington. I'm gonna vote to not authorize the Electoral College votes, and I'm gonna continue to fight this. So we don't know what the two US senators, where it looks now that they're not gonna, you know, be reelected, we don't know what they're going to do. And then as far as Reverend Raphael Warnock, he also woke up this morning, just like Governor Kemp, and said, okay, I got to go govern. I got to go to Washington now and be in, you know, this independent voice and work with everyone. But his election, his reelection started started on Wednesday, the day after the election. So he's got to get right back into campaign mode. He's got to show that he could be a base plus sort of moderate Democrat, but also strong enough where he doesn't, you know, get any opposition from the more progressive wing in our party. So I think
And what do you bet that Chuck Schumer will give him lots of high profile things to do to build up that resume really quickly in advance of the next election?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what, you know, now, because I'm about to call him that hopefully really soon, that's what Majority Leader Schumer is going to probably do to make sure that he's there. So, and last thing I'll say is this. I have said on this podcast for months now that there's a proxy war going on within the Republican Party. And that is that who's going to emerge as the person, he or she, that can bring the Republican Party back together. But I think it's literally going to take years for them to rebuild from the tarnish, the chaos, the broken hearts, the, you know, people lives been threatening. It's going to take Republican years to try to rebuild the Georgia Republican Party, because I think it's just so divided right now.
Brian,
you know what's going to help with that? Can I tell you what's going to help with that? And this is going to be out of Republican hands. What's going to help is, you know, Republicans have taken a beating in the suburbs. They probably took a beating in the suburbs again last night, as they did in November, as they did in 2018. What's going to help bring some of those people who used to be Republicans back is the next 2 years of Democratic governance. You know, Raphael Warnock is, it seems, going to the Senate for a two-year term, and then run for a full six-year term after that. At no point in time during those 2 years will he be judged by Georgia voters on his ability to decorate for Christmas, or on his love of puppies, or on how he eats pizza with a fork or with his hand. That will never come to the floor of the U.S. Senate. Instead, he is going to have to make a choice between the progressive base. And let me tell you, this is not the old Georgia conservative Democrats. The Democratic Party in Georgia is a liberal party, period. I don't even think that they deny it. Raphael Warnock is not a base plus moderate. And he's going to have to show his true colors as a liberal when he gets to the U.S. Senate. And so he's going to face tough issues that will divide this electorate and will bring back some of those moderates that he did get the votes from this time, people who perhaps are just disgusted with what the Republicans have been doing lately. I have no doubt he got some of those votes of Republicans who are just like throwing their hands up in frustration. But what are those Republican voters, or those people who have, you know, go back and forth? What are they going to do when Raphael Warnock votes on decriminalizing the border, on taking away private health insurance, packing the court, adding states? That is going to be the proof in the pudding.
But Brian, now to the question about good night, bad night for Governor Kemp. Did he catch a break in a way with Kelly Loeffler losing? Because now Doug Collins, who would probably be his strongest primary challenger, has an option. He could run for the Senate now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of a pressure valve release there, isn't there? I mean, you had the president in Valdosta saying, hey, Doug, want to be governor? You know, obviously signaling that he would back a Collins run for governor. But, you know, Collins has been in the House since 2013. He has risen through the ranks there. I think the Senate is where he would prefer to be over running for governor. Just as Stacey Abrams passed up a chance to run for Senate because she wanted to be governor. And so that takes one major player off of the board for people who could primary Kemp. And one thing that you're hearing in Republican politics is this idea of a MAGA ticket that sort of takes on the statewide elected officials. And who would make up that ticket is the parlor game of the day. You know, my concern and my warning is that if there's a primary against our sitting officials who have bravely and courageously stood up for the rule of law, then it will provide a tremendous, perhaps unstoppable opening for Stacey Abrams and the Democrats. It will be the best thing that could possibly happen for Stacey Abrams. So, because there, despite the fact that Georgia is getting more Democratic and that trend has continued for a long time, we're going to go into a midterm where Republicans do better in Georgia. We are going into a midterm where the president is of the other party, and the president's party always suffers in a midterm. There are many reasons why Republicans have a chance at holding the seats they have in statewide offices. It's going to be a challenge no matter what. It's a 50-50 state. It's going to be a battle. But there are some fundamentals that would be in the Republicans' favor, but we've got to be strategic. We cannot have an internecine bloodbath in the primary next year and hope to bounce back.
On that point, Governor Kemp has called President Trump's repeated attacks on him and accusations, unfounded though they be, that the system was rigged and so forth, a distraction. And it appears that party chair, state party chair David Schaefer, seemed much more interested, at least publicly, in pushing the president's conspiracy theories than in getting the Republican ground game going for the runoffs. Is Schaefer in trouble here?
You know, I don't know what his motivations are. If I was going to defend the state party, what I would say is that we had a fairly strong ground game. I mean, again, we had over 2.2 million votes or whatever for the Republicans. So it's not like they dropped the ball. I think that they had to play some catch up with the Democrats when it came to making sure that they completely executed their absentee ballot program. You know, in the general, the Democrats did a much better job of making sure that their voters who had ballots rejected went into the elections office to have them cured. Republicans did not have an operation like that. And I think that they made up for that in the runoff. They figured it out and did a much better job. They had observers lined up and ready to go in the polling places and in the counting places, which wasn't always the case in the general election. So I think the state party did a lot of things right. Now, I'll close with this. But, you know, Schaefer is somebody who has run for statewide office and came really close. And so, you do have to wonder if he is calculating a pathway to running for statewide office.
Theron, the Democrats have to know who they're likely to face as they look at the Republicans try to sort themselves out. So what's your take on who they might be confronting in 2022? Which brand of Republican?
Yeah. I think what Democrats are going to do today, Dennis, is just enjoy this win. I mean, you know, we're not in the position that the Republicans are in. And I just want to say this for our listeners and our viewers. You know, I just want to spend less time talking about what the Republicans did wrong and more time talking about what the Democrats did right. We had a better ground game. We had more talented people. We had better candidates. We raised enough money, not more. It was just our time. And so, you know, I think the media has got to really make sure that they spend, again, less time talking about Donald Trump, who, by the way, Dennis, we cannot normalize this behavior from the president. It is despicable. It is terrible. All right. It is bizarre. And again, I'm sitting here getting text messages of basically his supporters. They just breached the United States Capitol. They are literally, you know, trying to cause chaos. And where are the Republicans calling on these Trump supporters to do what they call Black people thugs? Let's just talk about where we are in the country. The president is in hiding at a time when his supporters are destroying the United States Capitol, right? And so, you know, I just want these same Republicans who went out here and blasted people who peacefully protested, but then you did have some destructive people that were out here, you know, destroying buildings and vandalizing businesses and all stuff. Where are those Republicans now? And so this is the thing I think that why Democrats won is because Republicans voted for Trump for whatever reason, but a majority of people in Georgia, and I'm done with this whole, you know, we're 50-50 state. No, we're a blue state. All right, we're a blue state. We took out an incumbent, two incumbents, three actually, if you look at it, if you count the congressional one. You don't go from that extreme.
That's the 7th district in Gwinnett County primarily, although there are other counties.
Yeah, well, I mean, we wanted to see, right? And we defended Lucy Medved. So no, we're not a 50-50 state, and we're not purpling. We're blue. And the reason we're blue is because the Republicans are creating this chaos that we're seeing playing out right now in Washington. And if we're not careful, it's going to play out here in Georgia. And that's why, you know, in this podcast, Dennis, you do a phenomenal job of bringing two individuals together who are friends, but also are way apart as far as policy and partisan, you know, promotion, right? But we have a very sensible conversation. But I'm not going to sit back and let the narrative from the media, not you, Dennis, because you do a good job of calling ball and strikes. So what? Trump blew it for him. It's that easy. Trump blew it for him. He was the most destructive president that we've ever had in our history. He came to Georgia, and Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler had an opportunity to break away from him. They didn't. And let's talk about how Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, a guy who lost, who at my house when Brian had a chance to talk to him, he knew then that he was going to make a comeback. He didn't probably think he was going to win. This guy literally, you know, came back and ran a really good statewide race. I mean, I don't want to go on a campaign to have someone call me a trust fund baby, say that I'm a white privileged Jewish kid. These are not my words. These are Senator Perdue's words, right? And the guy took it with grace. He never got angry. He continued the campaign. Let's talk about Reverend Raphael Warnock, Dennis. I mean, they exposed this man's personal life. They took clips of his sermons and pieced it together to make him out to be this crazy guy. And he ran a wonderful campaign. And yeah, you know, wrapping himself with Christmas lights, that was a little much, Brian. I agree with you on that. I mean, I probably would have struggled with that a little bit if I was a candidate, but it worked. And you attacked, Kelly Loeffler attacked the pastor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s church. And I'm telling you, that was the key mistake here. So again, I just want to continue to push the positive narrative for Democrats and forget about what Republicans did wrong.
Let me ask you real quick, and I want to make sure we have time to get to just one or two other things besides the runoff. But on runoff night, I spent some time with our colleague Rose Scott looking at how Georgia had never been this important before in national politics, at least not within living memory, and at least as a state full of voters, as a state by itself. We've had many individuals, for instance, from Georgia, from Dr. King to John Lewis to Newt Gingrich to Stacey Abrams, who've made major marks on the nation's politics. And in that list, by the way, I skipped over the president from Georgia, Jimmy Carter, so I want to make sure to add him now and correct that. But now, Georgia's millions of voters, Brian, are going to be among the states that matter nationwide, at least for the foreseeable future. What's that going to look like?
Well, okay, so there's a conflict here, right? So we're either going to be a state that matters, that people look at for years to come, or we're what Theron just said, a decidedly blue state. I disagree. And it is a 50-50 state for now. And here's why. Yes, Theron's right. Huge Democrat wins this year in Georgia. Biden, it looks like two Senate seats, the 7th congressional district. No doubt about it. Those are massive, big steps for the Democrats. That said, Republicans maintained strong control of the General Assembly. They got 52% of all votes for Congress back in November. And, you know, up and down the ballot, Republicans did very well going into the general election. Purdue did finish 2 points ahead. Ossoff was just below the 50% threshold. If you added up Loeffler and Collins's numbers on the other side, you had a very, very competitive ticket over there. And then just yesterday, we saw Bob McDonald, the Republican, in what is basically a generic ballot race win with the most decisive margin of the night. So I disagree that we're just a blue state, because if we're a blue state, that means we're not a competitive state, and we are a competitive state. Now, if the trajectory continues, the one that we've been on for the last 10 years, as Democrat gains go up, you know, let's say 50,000 every 2 years, if that continues through 2030, this is not going to be a competitive state. We're going to be Virginia. So what Republicans must strive for here is not a return to being a solidly red state. That's not going to happen. They must focus on being a solidly purple state, where we understand Democrats are going to win some big ones and Republicans are going to win some big ones, more along the model of Florida, which, just think, I mean, they have been a 50-50 state for 20 years, at least. I mean, Bush Gore came down to 500-something votes in 2000, and we're seeing one-point margins in the 2018 governor's race. And then, of course, Trump had a fairly healthy win there in 2020, but nobody thinks that it's not going to be competitive in 2024. So Georgia Republicans have to aim for a Florida model. Democrats are going to aim for the Virginia model.
Does that
Let me say this real quick, Dennis. Yeah. Dennis, in 2000, let me just go all the way back. In 2008, when President Obama ran, okay, don't get me wrong, it was a pretty wide margin. In 2012, you know, we didn't win. But in 2016, when Hillary Clinton came closer, no one called Georgia a 50-50 state. We called it a red state. And then when Stacey Abrams lost by 50,000 votes, Republicans and Democrats, but particularly Republicans, they called it a red state. So why can't we not call it a blue state now when we've won the presidency, we've taken back two U.S. Senate seats, we gained a seat in the 7th district, and we protected a member of Congress in Lucy Medved, who you guys spent hundreds of millions of dollars for. And so if we called it a red state in 2018, 2016, 2014, 2012, then why can't we call it a red state in 2020? You know, so again, Dennis, what I'm on here to do today. Yeah, blue state, sorry. What can we call it, a blue state 2020? The narrative, one of the things that the Republicans are good, and Brian get paid top dollars to do it, is to basically frame the narrative in the debate. No way, Brian. We are a blue state. The voters have shown you all that twice now.
A quick yes or no from you guys here, because we're really short of time. Does this mean, Brian, I'll start with you, that Republicans as they sort things out, are going to have to change their message, pivot toward the middle, pivot toward the new voters who are coming into Georgia and the young voters who are becoming eligible?
Well, it's not as simple as saying it's a pivot to the middle, because we certainly, both parties have been moving away from that, more toward mobilizing their own bases and then just, you know, leaving the independents and the people in the middle to, you know, to choose between the two options that they don't fully agree with either one. And it's impossible for Georgia Republicans to remove themselves from the national context. They can't just, as a state party, decide they're going to stand for something different than the national party. It doesn't work that way anymore. And the national currents will carry us to some degree. It's just like the move in the suburbs to the Democrats amongst white college-educated voters. That wasn't a Georgia phenomenon, just in the 6th congressional district, just in the 7th. It was nationwide. So there's going to have to be some national currents that Republicans ride. And one of those national currents is going to be the governance of Democrats in Washington over the next 2 years. It's going to provide some openings for Republicans. And look, the issues that we debate and about which we polarize, about which we line up on different sides, they change from time to time. And then issues where we used to be divided, you begin to have consensus. I think during the Trump years, we've seen some consensus build amongst Republicans and Democrats about the need to take a firmer stand against China, for example.
Criminal justice reform is another one.
Criminal justice reform is another example.
Let me quickly interrupt you because I'm watching the clock here. Theron, I want to get your take on that, and then we have to move on to another very important subject. Go ahead.
Look, I think, the narrative is so important here. The two U.S. Senate candidates and all the people I talked about, but particularly the Biden-Harris ticket, didn't win Georgia because we were these radical, you know, left progressive people and candidates that the Republicans spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to make the candidates out to be. They won because it's a new coalition in Georgia. And I've been saying this for years now. You can run a base plus strategy. But Dennis, how many times you've heard me say on this podcast, base plus, you can turn out your base, but you can expand your electorate. And what Democrats were able to do successfully is that, yeah, these college educated voters, many of whom would vote Republican, didn't just vote for Democrats because all of a sudden they like Democrats. And yeah, they probably voted for us because they didn't like Trump. But we gave them something to vote for. You know, we talked about issues that matter to them. We didn't scare them. We didn't try to tell them that Black people were going to take MARTA up to your suburbs and break in your houses and steal things from them, right? No, we legitimately talked about issues that they care about. We talked about the economy. We talked about this deadly pandemic. So hold on, let me finish that. I think going forward, though, we've got to expand the electric a little bit more, because I think that there's a way for you to cement your stability on the left, you know, being very progressive base issues that matter to Democrats. But we got to continue to make sure that we don't lose those moderate Democrats, those independents, particularly independent men who I think voted for us this time. And so I think you can do both. You can be strong on with your Democratic base, but you also need to have some moderate tendencies and some policy issues where you can show some bipartisanship to continue to build upon this new coalition that we built in Georgia.
It'll be interesting to see if they can pull that off, but we're going to have to jump here very quickly, and we've got just a few minutes left. We can't leave this edition of Political Breakfast, though, without taking note of the numbers of COVID-19 cases that have been reported in this state, just as the governor is starting to talk about a plan for rolling out the vaccine. We have now seen cases, at least one, of that UK variant strain surface here in Georgia. The governor said in his latest press conference, at least as we speak, that people over 65 would be added to the sequence of folks who would be able to get the vaccine. It wouldn't come before or at the same time as healthcare workers and seniors in nursing homes, but he added them to the next group. And Brian, I'll start with you. Did it make sense to do that, as appealing as it might be, when we have seen state after state where, because of the slow rollout of the vaccine, seniors have been lining up for hours just to make appointments to get a vaccine? Did the governor, in a sense, jump the gun here?
You know, the governor is in a a challenging situation there, and I'm not going to second guess him because he's privy to a lot more information on this than I am. But here's what I want to say about the vaccine distribution and this strategy. It is an opportunity for Brian Kemp to change the topic. We need to move away from the election discussion, which is going to be a lose-lose discussion for him at this juncture. Moving toward the vaccine, having a coherent plan, presenting his vision, building public faith, and rallying people to his ideas is a way for him to move on to a new thing. I would like to see it be discussed in the State of the State address when he does that in the coming weeks. So it presents a challenge, but it presents an opportunity at a time when he needs a good pivot.
Yeah. Theron.
I agree with Brian. I mean, I think, listen, you know, day by day in this state, Dennis, the numbers are going up. And we knew this. I mean, we've talked about it on the podcast. Brian has sort of talked about how we got to reopen, you know, keep businesses open. I've talked about how we needed a phased approach, but continue to ask people to be responsible, wear your mask, wash your hands, socially distance, don't go out in large crowds. But let's talk about this too. You got hospitals that are just overcrowded. You know, many of my wife's friends, and my wife's a doctor and her friends are on the front line. They tell her night after night about how, you know, you don't want to really probably get sick with COVID-19 right now because you probably won't be able to get the proper care you need because the hospitals are overcrowded. And so I agree with Brian. I think this is a perfect opportunity for Governor Kemp to come and start talking about the vaccine. We've said many, many weeks that the vaccine was going to roll out slowly, you know, healthcare workers, our seniors. And lastly, Dennis, and I'll close. I know we're running out of time. It broke my heart when I saw those lines of seniors, many of them carrying lawn chairs so they can just go 2 feet and then prop their chair down and then sit there for another 30 minutes before there's any movement. That is ridiculous.
How do we avoid scenes like that here?
Well, it all starts with Trump. I mean, again, you know, I'm looking at the television now and I see all these people that have breached the Capitol. You know, no one is out here trying to basically come up with a federal strategy to deal with this vaccine, to make sure that our seniors and our healthcare workers and our frontline workers get access to this vaccine and we move forward. So it's just really sad that, you know, the day where Democrats have won and we tried to save the democracy of this country, you have people on the other side that are trying to destroy this country as we sit here now and try to have a civil conversation.
Brian, just very quickly, the governor has to be looking at the scenes that we watch in Florida, for instance, and say, I don't want that happening here. How does he make that? How does he avoid that?
Well, you know, earlier in the year, we had almost daily COVID news conferences. And of course, the one thing that the people remember is when Kim said, you know, that we just found out that you can be an asymptomatic spreader. Of course, that was really blown out of proportion. But nevertheless, there was a time when they were communicating daily on these topics. And I think we need to return to that for now. I mean, for one thing, I think as sick as we are talking about COVID, we're even more sick about talking about the election. So talking about anything else will be a bit of a refreshing change. And it is a chance for him to show leadership. And look, I think that so far we haven't been told what the plan is very clearly. And granted, we've had a lot of other things going on around here. I mean, we've mm-hmm. been a little occupied. Let's give everybody credit for that. But I think the governor would serve himself and the state well to over-communicate on this issue.
And that is where we will have to leave it. Quick program note, for those of you listening live, we are about to go to NPR breaking news coverage because of the disturbance at the U.S. Capitol. That will be in lieu of Here and Now. Meanwhile, no matter how you're listening, that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. We really appreciate you joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and most recently a senior advisor to the Biden Georgia campaign. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Great to be with you, Dennis.
Good day for Democrats.
And our thanks to Kevin Rinker, John Haas, Shelley Canavy for their production assistance. This is 90.1 WABE Atlanta. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.